Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB. 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren, and sitting across from me is Dave North Martino.
Hey Al, how you doing?
You know how I'm doing, come on.
Yeah.
I'm doing terrible.
Smoke and fires.
Yeah. You know, I don't need to worry about getting lung cancer. I just hang out.
And get just breathe.
Life. Yeah, just breathe. My God. Hot and smoky. And then it's warm outside, too. No, just. Oh, that was a bad joke. Anyway. Yeah, I know. Nobody's buying it. Let's see. Well, it's been another interesting week. And today we've got another great writer on, and we're going to be talking to her all the way from Scotland. That's the second Scottish in a week.
It is.
Yeah.
Who else is
Harris, Robert Harris.
Yeah.
He does. Oh, he wow. does. He might even be from the same publisher, and you don't know him.
No, actually, that is amazing because Scotland is so small, and all the writers know each other, and I've never met Robert.
Well,
I don't think
it's about time. He, yes. This is Denise Mina. Thank you for being here. Just we didn't get that in. But, you know, yeah, Robert had his haggis and wife and was ready to eat and tell us a story. And that was last week.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How lovely.
Yeah. It took a while. We didn't understand them, but it was. He really got going in some of these stories. But, no, wonderful man. And he's kind of doing, I think that was Crimson was his book. And it's about kind of a Sherlock Holmesy sort of.
Yes, that's right.
That style of writing and stuff.
That's amazing. That's so fabulous.
Yeah, he's a very interesting man. Very nice man. And so there we go. I don't know. You guys, Scots, are taking over.
That's right.
We are.
Wow. So where did it? So you are a multi award winning master of crime. Wow. How did you get that name? So where did you start in writing? Like, how did you get so good?
Well, actually, I was an academic and I was doing a PhD in law, and I realized no one's ever going to read this willingly, and unless I make it part of an exam. And I thought, you know, really what I think, if you want to disseminate interesting ideas about law, which is really what I wanted to do, I was just that nerdy. I thought, if you put this in a crime novel, people would read it to find out who the murderer was, and they would come across these really interesting ideas. And also I wouldn't have to use footnotes, which was heavy going. So I wrote a crime novel while I was supposed to be doing a PhD. And at that time, I was in a law school. I was teaching in a law school that was very interested in socio-legal issues. And we were all obsessed with detective novels and movies. So I wrote a detective novel and it got published. And I said to my academic supervisor, I'm giving up my PhD and I'm going off to be a crime writer. And he said, wow, that's amazing. That's how good an academic I was. He was delighted.
Go with it, girl. Go. Yeah.
So that was about 15 novels ago, and I wrote the Garnet Hill trilogy, and really I just saw a chance and took it, and just kept going, and, you know, I've just had tremendous luck, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you write one of these stories, like the new one that you've got, it's Rizzio, where does that come from for you? Do you just, like, dream up these? Like, where do your ideas come from for the stories?
Actually, it was really interesting because this was a commission from a publisher who wanted contemporary writers to write about incidents in Scottish history. But I'd actually already written a book like this. I wrote a true crime book. I write comics and plays, and I'll write anything that I find interesting. So I'd written a true crime story about a serial killer called Peter Manuel, and this is very much in the same vein. He said, make it a bit like that one. So it concerns a weekend during which Mary Queen of Scots's secretary was dragged out of a dinner party and murdered by 30 nobles, who all had a contract saying, let's kill the Queen and then we'll divvy Scotland up in certain ways and everyone will get their estates back and we'll reverse all these laws and make Protestantism the official religion. But the whole weekend turned on one small woman who was so old no one thought she was capable of anything. She was 50. And her name was Lady Huntley, but that was ancient then. I mean, she's just like, they were like, why aren't you dead? You're a woman and you're 50. And what she did was she smuggled out letters from one group, Mary, to this group outside the palace, and she got Mary to pretend to be having a miscarriage because she was pregnant with the man who would become James VI of Scotland, first of England, and bring the two countries together. And she got her to pretend to have a miscarriage. So she was basically screaming and pretending to miscarry all weekend because of Lady Huntley. So it all kind of, the whole thing hung on that story. But what I was really interested in was taking an oblique look at, you know, it's such a, there are so many historical events within that one weekend, but just to focus in really closely on their relationship and how that changed history. Because you always hear about the great men of history, but you never hear about the Lady Huntleys, who were carrying notes, and she was carrying chamber pots about as well, so nobody stopped to frisk her.
Right. You know, nobody stops me when I'm carrying my chamber pots around. They go the other direction. Well, you know, but so when you go back, like, of course, you've got a lot of history with your PhD, but it must be very, I don't want to say time-consuming, but it must take a lot of work. And research to get the details so accurate, because it's harder to find the information the further you go back.
Well, this is so well documented. That was one. I mean, I thought I would be making it all up, but actually, Mary Queen of Scots gave two sworn statements about everything that happened, and then one of the men who had organised the plot gave a sworn, an 11-page sworn statement that is full of lies. He's just lying the whole time. And he keeps, everyone's attacking everyone, and then he stops them to give a sort of legal defence statement. I mean, it's like the cops in the 70s used to commit what we call verbal perjuries, where they would go in and arrest a guy, and the guy would say, I did have those drugs, and this is a fair arrest, and they would stand up in court and say this kind of thing. But between those two statements, it's very well documented what happened, because everyone was there. So, you know, there was like every important person in Scotland had signed a contract and gave a version of what happened that night. So it's really well documented. And you can go into the rooms that it happened in.
Wow. Do you dress up in the outfits too?
I'm, I, you know, I'm not much of a one for that. I actually did a TV show recently retracing Boswell and Johnson's tour of Scotland. And one of the things was they said, we're going to have surprises. The production team said, we're going to have occasional surprises. But can you tell us what wig size you take?
What?
Look, I'm not confident enough to dress up in period costume on television, so I'm not doing
that. Yeah, it's like, sorry, I've got another appointment. Yeah.
That's not for me. So so when we filmed it, the other person who was presenting with me, Frank Skinner, he dressed up in period costume, and I just stood next to him and looked like a big huffy git.
So he had the woman's wig on. And...
No, he had... He had Richard. I mean, he looked boss, I have to say, and he had a periwig on, and he was loving it. I mean, it was it's how he should always dress. He looked amazing, but I didn't think I would look particularly good in it. But basically, you can go back to where everything happened, and there's a stain on the floor that's supposed to be the stain of from the murder, because they dragged this guy into a presenting room, and all the nobles took turns stabbing him. It was just like Caesar. Wow. It was very important that everyone was implicated. And there's a bloody mark on the floor that's supposed to be the mark of his blood, but it's not. I mean, obviously it's not. But so you get a real sense of, you know, the space that this thing happened in and how close things were and, you know, what it would feel like for 30 men to come through the door of this very small, quite intimate room.
Yeah, I guess you really can capture the mood or the feeling when you go to a location like that too, right?
Very much so. And, you know, when I'm writing fiction, I usually try and work out where all the characters live, because that gives you a real sense of, all right, they're this far from a pub. They have to walk there to, you know, they park near their house. Do you know, it just gives you a real sense of it. And going back to Hollywood Palace to reimagine that, and the small staircase they all came piling up, and how drafty it is and how cold it is, and give you a real sense of what it must have felt like, and how close they all were to each other.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I think a lot of people don't realize the context of some of these stories, you know, when they grow up now. Yeah. And they read something, they don't necessarily feel it the same way.
I think especially since Game of Thrones, because we imagine everything on a huge scale. Yeah. And actually, you know, lots of things just happened in rooms that really, you know, if you saw a flat and it was Mary, Queen of Scots apartments, you would say, yeah, no, I think I'll just take something else. It's not really big enough.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. I guess we get quite spoiled as time goes on, you know. Did you find out anything that you were surprised about when you were doing the research or putting this together?
Lady Huntley's husband was stuffed. His body was stuffed, and he was put on trial for treason by Mary, Queen of Scots, before any of this happened. Now, I've never ever heard of that before. What had happened was he had led a rebellion against Mary, Queen of Scots. He died on the battlefield of a massive heart attack, but they needed to try him as a message to everybody else. So they taxidermied his body with straw, and then they stood him up in Parliament and they put him on trial. And Lady Huntley still helped Mary, Queen of Scots. So either she was an extraordinary woman or her husband was a very bad man.
Well, that's crazy. Did he testify?
Uh-oh.
How can you do that? I mean, that's ridiculous, right, when you think about this.
Well, you know, you think about olden days and you think, yes, it was quite brutal then and people did get killed. But what you don't really think about is just how damaged everybody was. People were so, so damaged, you know. And one of the things that I had to cut out of the book, because I just went on for far too long about it, was the social meaning of public executions at that time. When there was a consensus about everyone was Catholic, you know, a public execution was an opportunity for someone to die a good death because they could repent just before they died. And one of the problems with Catholicism was you didn't know when you were going to die. That's why people were never out to chapel. But once that consensus broke down and there were Protestant martyrs, the meaning of public executions all kind of evaporated and they just became gory shows. I had to cut that out because, as you can hear, I can't stop banging on about it. And they said, this is half the book.
Well, but I think it's an important point. I do, because, I mean... is it really all that different today? Like if we had, if there was a pay-per-view, you know, of someone being executed, would people buy it?
They would. They really would. Actually, they had to. I mean, I would disapprove of it, but I would want to know what happened, because human beings are, you know, drawn to excesses, and if you give them some justification, you know, they're very interested in that. But I mean, at one point, it had a very distinct spiritual meaning, and that was all lost at that particular point. I think that's really fascinating. And, you know, the idea of people being able to make a final confession, all of that evaporated and it just became really brutal and spiteful. And actually, one of the reasons that public executions were stopped in Britain was not because they were considered brutal, but it was because the crowd watching behaved so badly.
Oh, well.
Yeah, there were riots and there was quite a lot of public fornication.
Oh, that's, you know, that's all right. We do that a lot on this show. but I could imagine. So that would even be better. Now we'd have a more of an excuse to run it. The UK should be running it now because they could do it on TV and people will behave.
Yeah, because you've dissipated the crowds. It's such an ambivalent thing, isn't it? It's so interesting that, you know, that sadism is, you know, such an uncomfortable thing for people to deal with or acknowledge that you know, we like bad people to be other people. But, you know, to unpack, I mean, I write crime and often I read crime and I think that wasn't bloody enough for me. I'm not interested in jewel thieves.
Yeah.
You know, we don't all watch CSI because we care about justice. So there is a wee bit of that in everybody, a little bit of spite, a little bit of othering. You know, a little bit of witnessing brutal events, and you know, for some people, it would be a high point. I mean, I think a lot of sports, maybe boxing. I like watching boxing. Mm. Maybe boxing substitute for that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, then you're not going to like my books.
You think you write about missing lion
no,
tickets?
No, I do true crime, but I don't get into the gore too much.
And is that because you're uncomfortable, or you think it's unnecessary, or you think it's unfair to the victims?
Well, I think it's more about the victims. You see, on the older books that I write, you know, where everyone's passed and gone, it's 100 years, I can be more open about that sort of thing. But on some of the later ones I've written were people that are still alive and their family, and there's still a lot of people around, and I don't think it's needed.
People ever write to you and say you went too far?
Yeah.
Even though you're very careful.
Oh yeah, and I think it's really important to make sure that the victims are as comfortable as possible.
Absolutely, but then your line might not be my line.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm incredibly careful about that, and people have said to me, thank you so much for doing this. And other people have said, I can't believe you did that. You'll do anything for a buck.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting ethical conundrum. Should we not talk about this? Should we never talk about military history or question decisions that were made? Because that's the same issue, isn't it?
What I did was, like, on this last one that's done really well, I actually went to the victims that remained and the family, and asked them what they felt comfortable with, because what this guy had done to their two little girls was pretty, you know, horrific. And so I made sure they were comfortable, because not only that, I don't think the reader needs to know all the gory details to understand the story, you know?
Yeah. Or maybe the aspect of the story you're interested in.
Yeah, yeah, I'm quite interested in the results of how everybody moves on and kind of what goes on in their life, and try to follow it that way. So, so I guess that's sort of it. But enough about me. Nobody cares about me.
Oh, no, doesn't tell me. Oh, it sounds really good. What's it called? I'm writing it down.
No, advice. Well, just give reference to me then on your next. Do you ever worry about the way things like this go, like with Mary Queen of Scots and the whole empire and government, and we were talking about this before, like coups and stuff like that. Do you think that's just going to be a regular thing that happens with humans, just this sort of scenario, but maybe in different times or different equipment, so to speak?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, you know, coups are subtler and power grabs are more subtle. And, you know, I think it's, you know, people are aware of the fact that, for example, January the 6th did not play well. You know, the whole point about the story is it is an elite fighting amongst themselves, and the only casualties are working people. And for me, that was what really came over in the story. The only two people who were executed were two nothing burger guys who genuinely believed in this religious cause. And the people who had contracts with the other conspirators saying, I will get my estate in Moray back, nothing happened to them because they were too powerful. So, I think that happens constantly. And it doesn't just take a coup. But it's very important to remember that you know, these battles are never really about sharing power. They're about taking power. And it's usually a very small group of people who are taking that power. And they're not interested in what happens to other people. If anyone goes to prison for January the 6th, it will not be Trump or anyone who facilitated Trump. It will be, you know, small people who are just casualties.
Right, right. People that got caught up in it and went down and did the thing, and then they'll pay with their time and whatever.
Who I have sympathy with, because these are true believers, and they did, they drank the Kool-Aid and they believed all that stuff. It's the cynics who orchestrate that, who they know that these people are not maybe very stable, and they're quite prepared to use them, and they don't care what happens to them afterwards. I think that's damnable.
Do you ever wonder why, but with people, why this is an ongoing thing? Like, why do people fall into worship another human so much that they'll do things like that, or they'll risk their own life and family to go and get something of a change, which, you know, there's never ever going to be the change that they want. They're never going to get that idea that they're sold.
Well, I mean, I think it's religion. I don't mean, you know, classical religion, but I think it's people love to have an absolute belief, and they love being excited and carried away. And they don't really, it's very difficult to accept that all of life is chaos. That's a very uncomfortable truth. And people want absolute bad guys and absolute good guys, and they, you know, they curate the information that gets into their head so they never have to say, you know, we had an independence referendum here. And the most intelligent person I met said, it's very difficult for me. Everyone had a position. He said, it's very difficult for me because I can always see both sides. And I thought, you're a genius. That's how you dissipate this, is you try and see both sides. You know, when you take an absolute position and you're angry at anybody, say to yourself, well, what are they thinking? How do you think they're thinking? But that, you know, it takes a lot of emotional work, and it's much more exciting to believe that you're absolutely going to solve everything, and they're stealing children. When you go back in history, everyone's always doing things to children. That's how you get people to go to war. In the First World War, the Germans were attacking children. During the Reformation, Catholics and or Protestants were killing children. It's always about children. So it's always very frothy and emotional. I can see I could really get caught up in something like that if I wasn't a bit melancholy. And maybe was fitter or had a car. I think it's just intoxication.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we've been on the eating baby, you know, on pizzas, you know, and Hillary Clinton and all that, right? I mean, it's the same thing. There's this real, that's what I mean. I think what you say is right, because you take someone that has the answer. This person is correct. This is the way we needs to be. And the other ones are evil.
Right? Yeah. So anyone who tells you they have the answer is a liar or an idiot. That's a good principle upon which to work, is that, you know, this is going to take, you know, like the climate change it's going to take a lot of effort and everyone's going to have to make a big effort. We're all going to have to think about it a lot. Isn't it easier just to say that's not happening? It's much, much easier. I mean, think about those two options, you know. It's a lie. I mean, that's why people are attracted to easy answers and leaders who say they'll fix everything.
But it's never happened. I've never had, in my lifetime, I've never seen a leader fix anything.
They don't. I mean, it's all based on this myth that government can do everything. You know, that this tiny government are going to sort out the world economy and fix the oil price. They're not. And then, of course, when they don't, they have to say, well, this other government was stopping us. But, you know, I mean, I'm now ages with people who are senior politicians, and I just don't know how they can think they're going to fix everything. I can barely get out of the chair to turn the television on.
Well, yeah, I always say that too. I mean, you know, especially with the conspiracies, you know, like, you know, COVID's not real, or it's, you know, it's all planned and faked. And I'm thinking the government can't even pave your road. How are they? you know, I mean, this is the incompetence in humanity is just is huge, and that's in every field. And so you can't.
You know, one of the things about secrets is if three people know a secret, one of them's going to tell everyone.
Always, always. It's like they haven't landed on the moon, and they've kept it secret for like 60 years. And you're like, yeah, all of the employees and all the pilots, and you're thinking, not one person ever talked, you know. I know.
Mafia guys tell everybody.
You have to be careful not to get too political, I would say. I don't like that word, but not to get too righteous wrong sort of toward any of your characters and ideas.
Well, it's interesting because it's very old. It's a very old story. So you can talk about it and you can talk about it honestly. And actually, you can't live in Scotland and not argue with people about politics. You just can't. And so it's, I think, trying to avoid it, trying not to offend anybody. But I think the most important thing is it's such an interesting story. You don't need to take a position on it. You know, you really don't need to. I mean, at one point, everybody in Edinburgh realised something was happening in the palace. And they all grabbed torches and stormed down to the palace to try and stop it. And it was just like an incredible, incredible weekend. So much stuff happened that, you know, you could politicise it or you could not politicise it. But it's essentially an argument that's been rumbling around Scotland since.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The dawn of time, and you know, it's a good enough story without me superimposing my political position on it.
Yeah, well, that's pretty interesting. So with something like this, how do you get into the characters? Like, how do you get into these people and try to come across of how they would feel and act and what they would do? I mean, you've got sex, secrets, and lies, right, sort of. So when you get into that, how do you try to encompass that?
Well, I think, you know, just trying to imagine, probably very much like you, trying to imagine what it looks like to somebody and how it feels to them. And obviously you can't do that because it's so far in the past. This is like the 16th century, so... But just trying to, I mean, one of the central characters for me was a man who had been a priest, and then he became a Protestant, and he basically became an assassin. And on the night of the assassination, he wandered down to Edinburgh and killed a priest, and maybe killed two priests, actually. And I found him fascinating because he is, you see him all the time now, it's not hard to imagine, he is one of the people who stormed the castle on January the 6th. He is the guy that everyone has wound up and can't be stopped because he is a true believer. So he was very easy to get into. Mary, Queen of Scots, I found quite difficult because she's very young. I mean, she's only like 23 or 24 in this. But I try to imagine it as the moment when she realises that she's not going to be able to fix it, because just before this happened, she was just about to make herself safe and she was just about to go into her confinement to have her baby. So that, you know, I mean, I think most women can certainly imagine what that's like. And then she suddenly realises that nothing's going to be okay and it's all chaotic and she's married to a vicious idiot and her in-laws are trying to kill her. That was basically my sort of end point with her.
Well, I wonder, when you write your characters, do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear your characters in your head? I know I hear voices, but I'm wondering if you have an inner monologue or if it's more images and symbols that you're kind of transcribing when you write.
It's very much images with me, so I can see the scene. That's why the place is, the location, so important, because if I can see it, then I can smell it, and then I can feel it, and I can feel directional heat. And I don't know if you've read Snow by Bulgakov. He describes writing a play, and he describes writing it, and he says that he saw a box, and then he just wrote down what happened in the box. And that feels very much like my process. But do you hear written language or do you hear spoken language?
I guess I hear both. You know, I can hear.
Wow.
I actually hear the prose in my head, and I kind of transcribe it, and I hear the characters' voices. So I'm insane.
Yeah, he's a complete nutball. He's not anybody you want to meet on the street.
No.
None of us are terribly well, to be honest, writers.
And he's not even doing drugs.
So. I know. I get a star.
Do you ever see the language in your head written down? I had a friend who saw text.
No, I typically do see, you know, things like a movie, the images and stuff. So I transcribe from that way too. But yeah, I just hear and then I see visual images. I see things and I hear things. But yeah, that's fascinating, though, about seeing the text.
Yeah, he saw it written, and he could even describe the font that it was in.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, more to Denise, must, she dresses up like Mary, Queen of Scots. And
I do, too.
Yeah, well, the difference is she's writing about Mary and you're not.
Oh, okay.
That's an issue, okay? Now, how do you feel like when you complete a book like this and you look back at it, do you think it's made a change in yourself somehow?
I'll be honest with you. I wrote this book in a panic. I'll be honest with you. I write every book in a panic because I never believe it. And I always go and see this one friend and say, I don't think I can do this. I don't know what I'm doing. It's just like rubbish. It's just like bits of rubbish. And she says, you say this every time. She swears a lot. This every time. So when I finished that book, I just thought, oh God, I hope that's all right. And then I got it back and they were very, very excited about it. And I got it back and I reread it and it wasn't what I thought it was. It was much more exciting than I thought it was. It is quite, and it's very short, but it's quite exciting. And then people started reacting to it. And it's a really strange bit of story because it's such an ignoble story about, you know, Scotland loves its history. The history's always about, you know, the underdog winning out, do you know what I mean? And this sort of story is the sort of story Scottish people do not like to tell about ourselves, where everyone with power attacked a pregnant woman in the hope that she would die of a miscarriage. It's really dishonourable. Nobody comes out of it well. And so it's a story that people kind of know, but they really don't know anything about. And it felt like a very important story to tell, but I only saw that when I was reading it again. When I finished it, like everything, I just thought, God, that was a misbegotten bit of nonsense. Yeah. I could have done that better if I'd had 10 years.
Right. Yeah, I have the same impression when I write as well. I get the same, this is a pile of garbage, and I'm stressed and panicked, and then you get it back, and then, yeah, and I'm going through it, and I go, well, it's not, no, I guess it wasn't as bad as I don't know what that is. Some sort of,
I think it's like a room, and the only bit that your eye is drawn to is where you went over the skirting, and that's all you can see in the room. And then sometimes, if you go away for a long time and come back to it, you say, that actually doesn't really matter that much. But you need to get to the point where you're hypercritical. I think most writers have a committee of critics on their shoulder who say, this is all garbage, and that's how you make it better. But it's not very enjoyable.
Yeah, no. It's not. When people say they write for enjoyment, I want to slap them.
Writer who didn't criticize his own work, and it was awful. It was the worst thing I've ever read, and he just said, this is it, it's finished, it's brilliant. And it was just mince. And it's just the most flat nonsense. He had a great weekend. It was a writing weekend. He had a lovely time. But I realized that critical, that discomfort with your own work is very important, I think, to make it better.
I wonder also, after writing a piece of fiction, do you have a way to decompress, or do you even need to decompress? Can you just move on to the next thing?
No, I just move on to the next thing, to be honest with you. I'm usually panicky about the next thing. I mean, when you're at book festivals, it looks as if you're very casual and cool, but I'm just glad I'm sitting down and I'm not.
Yeah,
should take. I understand that.
I'm quite greedy and I do too much.
you see.
But then I look back at it, God, you know, I've had some great adventures, and I've had to, you know, people have let me do amazing things. I wrote Hellblazer for DC Comics for a year. I can't quite believe they let me do that, you know, and that was fitted in between books. So I don't tend to decompress. I tend to just move on to the next thing, and it feels like decompression because it's a different, it's very often a very different form, like I'm writing a play or something like that. Do you take time out?
I do. I tend to, you know, do martial arts. That's kind of my my escape, going to something physical after doing something that's more mental. And I guess I am very mental.
And so would you go off on a weekend to do that, or would you just make that the center of your day?
I do both. Sometimes I'll do a seminar, sometimes especially like after I'm done writing, I'll pick something and just go and train, you know, for 30 minutes to an hour or something like that, just to, you know, refresh my mind.
Get back in your
and then he wipes out the buffet afterwards.
Yes, after that, yes, absolutely. You were talking about Hellblazer and the doing graphic novels, and you adapted the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo into a graphic novel. I'm just wondering, what's your process for adapting a novel or movie to a graphic novel, and how is it working with another writer's characters?
It's really fascinating. It's so interesting because it's such a constrained form. So what I usually do is I read through the book and then go by chapter by chapter talking events, because comic scripts are so constrained and they work in a really different way to prose. And actually, it's really changed the way I write prose, because you have to have teasers to take you onto the next page. You don't close down a beat at the bottom of a page. You want to close down the beat halfway down the page. You have to think about how the artist is going to do the illustrations. What you can use for a splash, which is like a full page big reveal. How you're going to cut down all the dialogue. From prose to comics, no one can really have an internal dialogue. Normally in crime fiction, right, you get all the clues and then the detective goes off and has a think, and they get drunk or something like a bar fight. Realize something that they probably couldn't work out from those clues, but it works. Now, in graphic novels, you can't do that. You have to see everything.
Visual medium.
It really makes you... it's really interesting writing exercise. And you can't really have more than 30 words of dialogue in any single panel.
Wow.
Or it takes up to space for the art. Yeah, it's like haiku.
Wow.
And so much shorter since I wrote comics, because it's such an intensely disciplined form.
Wow, that's amazing. Sounds like...
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Dave likes discipline.
Well.
So now, do you have a website or a place that you like people to, fans to come find out about your writing and more about you?
Well, DeniseMina.com, and I'm on Twitter as Dame Denise Mina. I fraudulently claim to have a damehood, and now people think I do have a damehood. Quite often I'm on the news and they write me up as Dame Denise Mina, and I haven't the heart to tell them, no, that was a joke.
That's it,
And now they're in on it, so that whenever I'm on the news, they always put up Dame Denise Mina because they think it's really funny.
That's awesome.
Shamble on.
Yeah, they don't call me Dame, but they call me others. So how was it? Did you have any issues with the pandemic and all the wild west weird stuff the last couple of years? Do you find it gets involved in your writing?
Well, I'm trying to not write about it because when I sit down to write something, I always think, what do I want to read? And I don't want to read about the pandemic or people panicking I want to read about people traveling. So I'm now writing a book about someone who finds a casket that belonged to Pontius Pilate, and it may or may not have proof of Christianity in it. And people go on a big journey and they have to travel all around the world. It's a follow-up to a book called Conviction. Because what I really wanted was to escape, to not think about this, to pretend the world was normal, and to go travelling. So I thought, that's what I'm going to write for people.
Well, yeah, but does the darkness seep into your writing? Do you feel stressed? Like, not the normal panic of being in the edit process or writing, but the actual, you're sitting around and you're putting together a story and writing, and there's stressful things going on outside. You may not write about it or include it, but does it become a little darker, your writing, do you think?
Well, it's funny because I think my writing is always very dark, and I go to Scandinavia and people say, oh, your books are very funny. And then I go, I'm a bit depressed. I'm like, well, it's cultural. Do you know what I mean? And I think, everything is quite dark. And my base mood, I think if you're, I really think that kind of blatant darkness is very much the purview of young people. As you get on a bit, dark things happen, and the giggliest people I know are the people who have lived through the darkest things.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think there's any point in, you know, I'm not going to books to find out about stuff like that. But obviously it's there. You know, my mum's been in and out of hospital for 2 years. Uh-huh. So I've been right in the heart of the pandemic, and she got COVID and got out, and then she and she was desperate to get home to smoke, and she's a wife, and she's still here, you know, she's amazing, you know. And so that, I mean, it has been really terrifying, and I just feel like I don't think I'm going to be reading for to be terrified. It's interesting because, you know, really gory books, I think they're very much about being in a state of peace. And I don't think people in war zones read books about serial killers chasing people around, yeah. You know. I think books do different things, and I think we go to the arts for different things. And I think escapism has saved more lives than penicillin, and we should really acknowledge that.
Yeah, that's why. excuse me. That's why we laugh and try to have a laugh, because we do cover a lot of, you know, darker and more horrid stuff. So I think people sometimes they don't understand that, but I think it's sort of, you know.
Well, you know, be honest, if you don't understand why awful things need humor, then maybe truly terrible things have not happened to you. And if they have and they do, you're going to have to develop a sense of humor, or you're not going to get through them. It's such a blessing to have a sense of humor. And, you know, I don't think that you can separate things out, because life is just a big mess. And, you know, if you read something like The Arabian Nights, comedy's in there with gothic gore, with murder mysteries, and that is real life. We always separate these things out in books. I don't think we should do, because I think that real life is funny and terrible and wonderful and scary and, you know, awe-inspiring, and that's just realistic,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and for the listeners, you know, if you haven't lived through anything terrible or horrific like that, then Denise will come by. Just send her an email, and she'll give you something horrific to live in. And then you'll understand, right?
Are entitled to be miserable if you want to.
I'll tell you, you know. Well, that's interesting. And the latest thing when you're writing about Pontius Pilate and stuff. So how is that covering a religious sort of person like that, or someone that had a big, big place in religion and Jesus and stuff? Because there's, I don't know how it is in Europe right now, but in the States, there's really a sentiment that religion's under attack, and that people are trying to take away your religion and stuff like that. Do you think that there will be any sort of a backlash when you cover something like that?
I'm sure there will be, yeah. Huh?
It doesn't matter. Like, you just sort of go ahead and, like, whatever.
Yeah, you know, my purpose is never to offend people, and you can always not buy that book. And it's really not about religion. It's about the arts and artifacts market, and which is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, I mean, it is how you drug dealers who got tired stopped importing. Basically, US Customs realised they were getting Iraqi artifacts in the same packaging they used to find heroin in. And it was because drug dealers realised, oh, wait, I get 50 years for importing heroin, but if I steal, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh, I get 2 years if I import it into America illegally. So the arts and antiquities market is worth a fortune, an absolute fortune. And no one really talks about it in crime fiction because it's a bit complicated. And the market has heated up wildly because Hobby Lobby have opened a museum of the Bible. And they just went around the world throwing money around. They've recently had to give back a cuneiform tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and because they bought it and it was illegal. It was an illegal import. They really weren't sure what they were buying, but they were just very, very adamant, and they were throwing money around. I mean, it's just a fascinating world, and it's full of really mad characters and unlicensed priests and this kind of thing. So I don't think people are going to be offended, because it really isn't about religion. It's about the objects that involved in religion and the market around that, which I think is, you know, kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it's an interesting area. You can see people's behavior around such things. That's pretty far out interesting, you know.
Oh, really, you know, and I think a lot of people of faith would be very interested in having that questioned and brought out into the open. Because, you know, there are so many different schisms, and you know, my intention is, I mean, I come from a very religious family, and my intention is never to offend anybody. But, you know, you can be a cultural Catholic and talk about the culture of a religion without talking about the basic tenets of faith. So, I mean, I would never question any, and people have the right to believe whatever they want to believe. That's never, you know, I would never question that. I mean, you know, I believe things that are, you know, probably ludicrous to other people. So it's not really about faith. It's about that market and how everyone's afraid to look at it because there's so much money there. And there's a lot of middle class and upper class money there.
Oh, I need to get into that.
I'm writing that down.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, and there's so much going on with the Catholic Church. Hey, you hear about the all the bodies they've been finding in Canada, right?
Yeah. Yes, I have been, all the Indigenous children who died in state schools.
That's just crazy. I'm surprised it hasn't really made the American media.
Really? Is it not? Because it's big over here.
Yeah, no, America has been avoiding it. You know, this is NBC. No, and we follow through on the other networks, and I'm still waiting to see any of the real coverage. They seem to be more on the other things. They've got their plates full right now.
Yeah, I think so. But it really resonates with us here because of Ireland, you know, because there were mother and baby hospitals in Ireland, and they found a lot of unmarked graves of small children who died in those mother and. You know, I mean, I have cousins who were born in those places and could have been buried in unmarked graves. They found a cistern full of remains.
I wonder what they were doing with all those children. You know, we hear stories that there's tests being run on them.
I wonder in Canada if it was different, but over here it was almost certainly neglect. And, you know, to seeing it from both sides, just to be very boring, a lot of the people who worked in those places were incredibly damaged and really ignorant, and they were not trained to do the jobs they were doing, and they were brutalised and brutalising. You know, hurt people hurt. And, I mean, I was taught by nuns, you know, some of whom were like 17. And what were those girls doing going into convents at that age? That's no time to decide that you have a vocation. You know, that's the whole organisation, the way the institution was organised, it was 300 years out of date, and they were being left in charge of very vulnerable people. And I think that's what happened over here, but I don't know if, I don't know what happened, but I suspect it was neglect and disdain. I think that's really, you know, what killed all those people was nobody was watching, and the people that were working there didn't care enough to take care of people properly.
Yeah, I'm just shocked in how many there were in each of these schools.
Are...
Like one now is like over 700.
Wow.
Mother.
Yeah.
Were they very isolated?
Well, yeah, but they.
The schools.
But that's Canada, right? Canada, especially in the prairies, because you have a town. Even the first one where they found Kamloops, which is north of the desert here, you know, it only had, you know, 15,000 people in the city, and they were outside of it in their own private area, so they didn't even, they weren't interacting with any populations.
Well, there was an orphanage next door to my mother's village in Glasgow. My mum was one of 15. And the children from the orphanage, people kind of knew what was going on there. So I wonder, but they didn't think they could speak up because it was the church. And also because it was such a hard scrabble life for them. And there's been a big investigation into what was happening there. And children were buried there in unmarked graves. So the locals knew about it. And, you know, I think we have to look at it in context, but we also have to look at it and say, did people know what was happening? How can we stop this ever happening again? As well as looking back and making restitution,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you find these things. Pretty shocking, you know, but sure there's more to come, you know. Well, so now your book comes out on when? This is on pre-order right now. So when does it officially become released?
The very start of September.
Ooh, boy, lineups now. Pre-order now for this book, you know. It's been very, very interesting talking to you, and we've learned a lot, you know.
What a treat talking
to you. Yeah, you know, and we learned Denise likes to dress up and as Queen... Queen of Scots, and if you don't like to laugh, she'll come hunt you down, give you something to laugh about. I'll tell you.
Put the smile on your face.
You'll be crying. You're so happy. Oh well. Anyway, well, it's been interesting and a very good book. We're talking about Rizzio, and it's a novella. And that'll be out on September 1st. And, of course, we'll have that up on our website, and we'll have it where people can just do one click and pick it up. And don't forget, the website will be connected to ours as well. So we really had a good time, and you've done it all. So the great Denise Mina, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Denise.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.